there are other victims. One of them has already died. His son fears the consequences of telling his father's story and only accepts to talk if we protect his identity. This and many other cases come from the same region.
IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Whistleblower Everett Stern, who talked to the 6th of January panel, said FBI agents and the House panel investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol have both learned of a plan by allies of retired Army General Michael Flynn to gather intelligence on top U.S. Republicans to move them to back election audits in key states that Donald Trump lost. We now present you an article written by Peter Stone. The piece is titled, Michael Flynn Allies Plotted to Lean on U.S. Republicans to Back Vote Audits. Whistleblower Everett Stern, who talked to the 6th of January panel, said FBI agents and the House panel investigating the 6th of January attack on the Capitol have both learned of a plan by allies of retired Army General Michael Flynn to gather intelligence on top Republicans to move them to back election audits in key states that Donald Trump lost. Everett Stern, who runs the intelligence firm Tactical Rabbit, and is a Republican vying for a Senate seat in Pennsylvania, in multiple interviews with The Guardian said, two Flynn associates with the right-wing Patriot Caucus group enlisted his help in April in a scheme to seek potentially damaging information on two Republican members of Congress to prod them to back an audit of the 2020 presidential election that Joe Biden won. Everett Stern told The Guardian he spent several hours in November telling House panel investigators about the drive by Michael Flynn associates who sought campaign finance and other dirt on Pennsylvania Senator Pat Toomey and Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick to win their support for an audit to bolster Donald Trump's debunked charges that Joe Biden's win was fraudulent. A long-shot candidate to succeed the retiring Pat Toomey, Everett Stern said he alerted the FBI in June when he heard more details of the bizarre drive by Michael Flynn allies to specifically target the two Republicans, both of whom backed impeaching Trump after the 6th of January insurrection. The efforts by Michael Flynn's Patriot Caucus allies were launched after Donald Trump failed to block Joe Biden from taking office and are part of a wider drive by Trump loyalists and Michael Flynn to help boost Trump's political fortunes via more state audits nationwide into charges that Biden's win was rigged and elect like-minded candidates in key states to top electoral offices. Everett Stern provided text messages, emails, and other documents revealing he had multiple contacts with one of the Patriot Caucus members, Velma Ann Ruth, and two other influential Flynn allies, Houston real estate mogul Al Hartman and former Army Green Beret Ivan Raiklin, who were pushing audits in several key states. Everett Stern said Michael Flynn's Patriot Caucus associates first approached him in Pennsylvania for possible help after an April Republican Party event, and soon after told Stern in phone calls they worked with Michael Flynn and the Patriot Caucus and planned to recruit former domestic and foreign intelligence officials to facilitate their scheme. Planned by Michael Flynn allies alarmed Everett Stern, but as a former whistleblower involved in exposing a large bank money laundering scandal by HSBC in 2012, he told The Guardian he decided to play along for a few months to glean information to expose the Trump allies' scheme. Everett Stern expressed dismay that Flynn's Patriot Caucus associates don't understand that Biden is the president. They wanted to collect information through Tactical Rabbit and my campaign to turn up the heat on Pat Toomey and Fitzpatrick to back an audit which Stern viewed as potentially extortion. Everett Stern gave The Guardian a voicemail he received in which Al Hartman talked about leaning on moderate Republican rhinos in Pennsylvania to gain support for an audit of that state's vote, with Joe Biden won by over 80,000 votes, and Al Hartman said a similar drive in Michigan was needed. Everett Stern said Al Hartman wanted to use Tactical Rabbit's intelligence gathering tools and his campaign to dig up potentially embarrassing campaign finance information and other dirt about the Pennsylvania members, plus Republican political figures in Michigan who were also resisting audits. Everett Stern said Al Hartman and Raiklin also talked with Stern about meeting Flynn, Trump's disgraced former national security advisor, and proposed compensating him for his information via campaign donations. In an April exchange of Al Hartman text messages seen by The Guardian, Al Hartman asked a Michael Flynn scheduler to help connect Flynn with Everett Stern, whose Senate campaign and credentials he touted highly, calling Stern a strong believer in their cause. Although Everett Stern tipped off the FBI in June about what he deemed a threat to national security, and he said he met with agents again in November, it's not clear if his charges are still being pursued. Everett Stern's charges have echoes of Michael Flynn's scheming with Donald Trump and other loyalists in late 2020 to thwart Joe Biden's win, efforts that included a White House meeting with Trump where Michael Flynn proposed declaring martial law in several states that Joe Biden won and then rerunning the election in those states. According to an Arizona Senate document shared by the watchdog group American Oversight to coordinate national efforts, Raiklin and Hartman on 3rd of July spearheaded one of a series of election integrity calls with Trump loyalists, lawyers, and donors to discuss the status of audit efforts in several states and other plans to cast doubt on Joe Biden's win. Arizona document reads, "Join us every second Saturday for situation updates and collaboration from active leaders in the election remediation process at state level. Attorneys with Mike Lindell and Patrick Byrne, data analysts, state legislators, gubernatorial candidates, and grassroots activists whose goal is completing a cyber forensic audit in their state. A who's who list of Trump loyalists and groups invited to join these calls included the America Project and America's Future, both of which Michael Flynn played key roles with as they poured some $2 million into a discredited audit of Arizona's largest county. Plus the Patriot Caucus, Velma Ann Ruth, Fincham and Byrne, the millionaire chief financier of the Arizona audit. Al Hartman, in emails with Everett Stern obtained by The Guardian, invited him in June to attend a religious far-right meeting known as Ziklag in Dallas, Texas, where he could meet separately with Michael Flynn. Everett Stern said Al Hartman told him a private meeting was going to be arranged with Michael Flynn, who Stern was told wanted to meet him. After indicating to Al Hartman he would attend, Everett Stern opted to cancel at the last minute, after his lawyer indicated there could be legal repercussions from such a meeting. Al Hartman has long been a donor to the right. He is on the advisory council for the pro-Trump Turning Point USA and has been active in the conservative donor network led by oil billionaire Charles Koch. According to a military official who spoke to the Reuters news agency recently, Ray Klin, an Army Reserve officer who reportedly has known Michael Flynn since 2014, is facing an internal Army Reserve investigation into possible violations of rules barring partisan political activity. Reuters has reported Ray Klin in December of 2020 outlined a wild scheme in tweets and a podcast to thwart Joe Biden's win, charging a vast conspiracy theory that included Pence, intelligence, China, and big tech. Ray Klin told Donald Trump to activate the emergency broadcast system and deployed the hashtag #FightLikeAFlynn, stressing that we the people are going to force this plan on them. Neither Al Hartman or Ray Klin replied to multiple calls seeking comment. A Flynn scheduler did not respond to questions for the story. Velma Ann Ruth, with the Patriot Caucus, who was photographed with Everett Stern at a June event in Pennsylvania, said General Michael Flynn called Stern's charges delusional, fabricated, and defamatory. In a text message, Everett Stern said he shared the photo and other documents involving exchanges he had with Velma Ann Ruth with the FBI. Senior former prosecutors and intelligence officials say Everett Stern's charges merit law enforcement attention. Former prosecutor Paul Rosenzweig, who worked on Ken Starr's team during the impeachment of Bill Clinton, said Everett Stern's charges suggest serious crimes. If his allegations were corroborated by extrinsic evidence, they clearly would warrant an investigation.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a big welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today.
Stay tuned with Africa Today.
Africa Today.
Britain's Prince William has been condemned for the comments he recently made against the surge in Africa's population and its alleged impact on wildlife. Now, this senior member of the British royal family made similar claims in 2017. Let's take a listen.
In my lifetime, we have seen global wildlife populations decline by over half. Africa's rapidly growing human population is predicted to more than double by 2050. A staggering increase of 3.5 million people per month. There is no question that this increase puts wildlife and habitats under enormous pressure.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and a warm welcome to Africa Today, a weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. It's always great having you watch our show. Today, we are focusing on racist remarks by Britain's Prince William to the effect that the increasing population in Africa threatens wildlife. Now, his comments have attracted widespread criticism. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about the decision by the United States to impose trade sanctions on Ethiopia, Mali, and Guinea over claims of human rights violations and recent coups. Stay tuned till the end of our show as our experts analyze today's topics.
Prince William's racist view on Africans. Britain's Prince William recently repeated his position regarding what he termed as the pressure put on Africa's wildlife by human populations. In a speech last November at the Tusk Conservation Awards, he stated that the increasing pressure on Africa's wildlife and wild spaces as a result of human population presents a huge challenge for conservationists as it does the world over. The comments have been made while Prince William is the father of three children, leading to accusations of hypocrisy. The remarks by Prince William continue to attract harsh criticism from many people in Africa. Here's one such comment on Twitter by Dr. John Njenga. He says, "Mr. William has no moral authority to say anything about Africa or about Africans and their lives. He should spend his time reading good history books and raising his many children and spending time with his very huge family spread out across the world."
Now, for more on this subject, we contacted Professor Firoz Manji, an author, activist, and a professor of African studies at Carleton University. He's also a publisher at Daraja Press. Now, Professor, can we say that Prince William has a colonial mentality which still views Africans as colonial subjects?
Well, come on, you know, we're talking about a social parasite, you know, who lives on not only the wealth of taxpayers in the UK, but a whole inheritance of a family which has been deeply involved in enslavement, in slavery, in the riches from all that period, a family that has an enormous wealth in all the British former British colonies. In fact, people like Prince William and the royal family and so on, and a lot of these whites, white settlers in Africa, care more about preserving animals than they are about humans. For them, human beings are purely disposable.
Critics say the greatest source of harm to the fauna on the African continent was European hunters in the early 20th century. Even to this day, European and American tourists continue to illegally hunt African wildlife. Just to give an example, an American trophy hunter killed a famous Zimbabwean lion, igniting outrage across the world. Walter Palmer, a dentist and hunter, killed Cecile the lion outside Zimbabwe's Hwange National Park in July 2015. Here's the reaction of a Zimbabwean tourism official.
Cecil was an icon who was 13 years old and very well known by the international community. The reason why we are very disturbed and rattled by this development is that a lot of people travel long distances coming to Zimbabwe for the purposes of coming to enjoy our wildlife. And obviously the absence of Cecil, it's a disaster in terms of the disappointment it has caused and its absence in the industry, because it's one of the draw cards which really relied upon in the industry.
Now, European hunters entered Africa during the colonial period, and that is when the destruction of African wildlife started. Yet, Prince William blames African population growth for the shrinking wildlife. Now, Professor Manji, what's your take on this?
Well, you know, it is the royal family, Prince William's, and it is their collaboration with the transnational corporations who've stolen most of the land, and which means that that there is very little land left indeed for humans, but also for animals. And the reality is, I mean, if we talk about hunters, let's not forget that the royal family were deeply embedded from Elizabethan times in hunting for slaves. Hunting for slaves, killing for slaves, destroying civilizations for slaves. This was a hugely profitable enterprise. These were the original hunters of humans.
Now, illegal logging in Cameroon, the largest exporter of tropical timber to Europe, is posing a real threat to the country's forests that are its most valuable economic and ecological resource. Now, Professor Manji, you mentioned about land grabbed by European multinationals in Africa, leaving little for humans and wildlife. Can you elaborate further on this, please?
They destroyed large amounts of land in order to privatize it. And we've seen this continuity under neocolonialism, under the structural adjustment programs of the World Bank and IMF and so on. What you see now is even greater grabbing of land.
High consumption in rich, developed countries is driving forest destruction in many parts of Africa. Ancient forests are being destroyed to plant crops or raw material destined for Europe. For instance, to satisfy the European appetite for chocolate, massive forests have been destroyed in Ivory Coast to clear the way for cocoa plantations. According to estimates, in the last 50 years, the country has lost 90% of its forest cover. Cocoa was the main reason for this destruction. Why did Prince William conveniently ignore the fact that European consumption habits are responsible for the destruction of wildlife habitat in Africa?
The paradigm of these racists, because let's be quite clear, his whole framework is fundamentally racist, is to always blame the blacks. It's always blaming Africans.
Many agree that capitalism greed leads to the pollution of our air and water, soil degradation, deforestation, and the destruction of biodiversity.
The first step is to recognize that regardless of what particular variety of capitalism you're facing, capitalism is destroying the living planet. And if it's a sort of social democratic capitalism, it might take a few years longer than if it's a neoliberal capitalism. But it's still heading in exactly the same direction.
According to the United Nations, Africa only contributes 2-3% of the world's carbon dioxide emissions. Yet Prince William says African population growth is responsible for environmental destruction. Now, Professor Manji, what's your opinion on this?
Well, it's clearly wrong. It's not what is causing environmental destruction. The scale of environmental destruction carried out by mining companies, for example, especially Canadian mining companies across Africa, have huge impact in towards creating the conditions.
Now, the remarks by Prince William are not the first by a European leader. Now, in 2017, French President Emmanuel Macron faced backlash for talking about Africa having a civilizational problem because women are having 7 or 8 children. Now, Professor Manji, do you think the remarks by these European leaders are part of a long-term imperialist strategy of depopulation in African countries?
Absolutely. I mean, we have seen so many examples of the use of things like Depo-Provera, enforced sterilization. This is not something that's in the past. It is going on today. Enforced sterilization, often done secretly to women, is something quite outrageous, but it fits within this racist paradigm that you get from the discourse of these social parasites like Prince William. who can only see the fear that they have, and that that they are part of an inheritance. As I said at the beginning, his wealth comes from a long line of enslavement of humans, you know, and that was a massive, massive depopulation strategy for Africa.
Well, thank you very much, Professor Manji, for your insights. We now take a short break before the second part of our show that will focus on United States economic sanctions on African countries refusing to toe Washington's line. Stay with us.
U.S. trade weapon in Africa.
You're listening to Africa Today. Africa Today is an analytical weekly review of political, economic, and social events in Africa, the world's second largest continent. The series is broadcast every week on Saturdays and Sundays by IRIB English Radio.
The United States has cut Ethiopia, Mali, and Guinea out of a duty-free trade program known as the African Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA, over alleged human rights violations and recent coups.
Ethiopia's trade ministry said in November it was extremely disappointed by Washington's announcement, saying the move would reverse economic gains and unfairly affect and harm women and children.
For more insight on how the U.S. is using trade agreements to arm twist African countries, we contacted Tunde Osazua, a coordinator for the U.S. Out of Africa Network and a member of the Black Alliance for Peace. Now, the U.S. claims to care for the common people, yet its move against these three African countries will affect ordinary people. This is a classic case of collective punishment, which is common in U.S. foreign policy. Now, what's your take on this U.S. policy?
Absolutely. I think the removal of these countries from the African Growth and Opportunity Act is a form of sanctions. And sanctions are economic warfare that have, you know, devastating human costs. Like you said, you know, it is collective punishment that are part of the strategy of, you know, enforcing compliance. So by design, you know, the removal of these countries, right, like Mali, Guinea, and Ethiopia, that will affect, you know, ordinary people in these countries, and, you know, particularly rural women who, you know, work in, you know, manufacturing sectors. They'll be the ones who'll suffer.
Economic sanctions and embargoes have become the tool of choice to respond to governments opposed to the meddling by the United States in their countries. Canadian international criminal law expert John Philpott, in an interview with an Addis Ababa TV network, said the U.S. decision to remove Ethiopia from the African Growth and Opportunity Act privileges is meant to hurt the people and weaken the government of Ethiopia.
U.S. intention is to hurt the people. They want the people to hurt. They apply sanctions around the world and cause terrible suffering, starvation, lack of medicine, and in your country, they want to hurt your country so it's weaker, and so maybe the people will turn against the government. That is their thinking and their plan.
is the United States using trade with Africa as a tool to spread its imperialist and hegemonic control over African countries.
The U.S.'s unparalleled dominance over global finance and trade allows them and their allies to essentially own the world economy. With the complicity of the World Bank, you know, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization, that dominance is, you know, reinforced and expanded, and it allows the U.S. to selectively and unilaterally exclude, you know, any country at any time from participating in the global economic system. And so what we're seeing is that, you know, through this African Growth and Opportunity Act, you know, Mali and Guinea and Ethiopia are, you know, being excluded from participating in trade with the U.S. specifically. And, you know, and like I was saying earlier, this is, you know, kind of a form of sanctions. It's, you know, the U.S. and the European favored form of exerting control over the world.
Now, the recent U.S. meddling in Ethiopia, where it was seen as supporting the TPLF rebels, attracted condemnation by Ethiopian officials and the masses. Mali has also adopted a new policy and increased its engagement with Russia and other Eastern countries. Now, can we say that the reason these countries such as Mali and Ethiopia are being targeted by the U.S. sanctions is because of their decision to ignore orders from Washington and other Western countries?
You know, the crime of these countries is, you know, using their own resources to develop their own, you know, social progress rather than following the dictates of the U.S. and following the capitalist path. That's why they're singled out for these sanctions. And I think, you know, we should also understand that sanctions don't defend justice or human rights. They're illegal, they're immoral, and they're really terrorist acts of war that are applied against civilians, right, and inflict the greatest suffering on the most vulnerable, including children, including women, you know, the disabled. And so we should see this for what it is. I mean, I'm not saying that the African Growth and Opportunity Act is, you know, the most ideal arrangement or initiative or relationship between these countries and the U.S., but I think we should see this action as a form of sanctions and understand what those sanctions are.
Ethiopians worldwide responded to the U.S. interference in their country's internal affairs by organizing protests that have clearly angered the Biden administration. Here's one such demonstration in London.
No more!
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 No more! No more!
Resist!
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 Prevail!
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 Endure!
Endure!
Resist!
Endure!
Endure!
Prevail!
Prevail!
Ethiopia!
Ethiopia!
Will prevail!
Eritrea!
We have seen Ethiopian protesters vowing to resist U.S. meddling in their country. Can African countries sustain this resistance to U.S. pressure?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the No More movement is a great development. And what I'm aware of is that African people are constantly rising up. They're constantly resisting, even if we don't see that reflected in mainstream media. But I think what we should understand is that, you know, wherever there's oppression, there's resistance. And, you know, there's a lot of, you know, imperialist oppression on the African continent. And so as a result, there's a lot of resistance on the part of African countries or African people, rather.
The United States has been selective in enforcement of the AGOA violations. This is while previous U.S. regimes have ignored violations committed by other AGOA beneficiaries. Some experts say the U.S. targeting of countries such as Ethiopia could backfire.
And if you really see the import value, the import value from U.S. to Ethiopia is much higher than the export value from Ethiopia to the U.S. It means that U.S., if they close the export market from Ethiopia, we would naturally close the import market from U.S. That means U.S. is at a bigger loss than Ethiopia. you know, in terms of the balance of trade. There is a concept called balance of trade, that is the difference between export and import.
China and Russia are already moving in to fill the US gap in African countries. Do you think Washington's disengagement could be a blessing in disguise?
I think that is very likely. The US is already in decline on the world stage, and moves like this that weaken its relationships with countries on the African continent can only accelerate that decline. The U.S. already lags behind China in terms of trade with the African continent. You know, China's investing heavily in African infrastructure through its Belt and Road Initiative and its forgiving debt that's been demanded by the IMF, the International Monetary Fund. And so if China and now Russia are now increasing their influence in Africa, it's really because Africans see the advantage of having an alternative to the U.S. and to Washington. And I believe that these African countries have every right to do business with their ally themselves, with the states of their choosing.
Now, despite claims by the U.S. that AGOA will bring about change and improve the everyday lives of Africans, poverty remains widespread in the region amid sluggish progress and other mounting shortcomings. Now, Mr. Osazua, what should African countries do to avoid being vulnerable to U.S. pressure, as we have seen in the case of AGOA?
Right, like we need to see really a mass movement, right, for a united Africa. And I think we've already started to see, you know, initiatives on the part of African countries for, you know, greater unity, for unification. But it's really what I would like to see, what I think would be the most useful in terms of fighting back against, you know, U.S. and Western domination, is really, you know, a mass movement for unified socialist Africa that would, you know, really meet the needs of African people in ways that don't rely on initiatives or programs like the African Growth and Opportunity Act, right? Like, Africa should not be dependent on, you know, Western aid or neoliberal development projects like the African Growth and Opportunity Act. We need, you know, initiatives, we need programs, we need development, initiatives that are seeking to improve the lot of African people en masse.
Well, there you have it. Africa needs real unity to avoid dependence on exploitative economic programs such as AGOA imposed by Western countries. Thanks a lot, Mr. Atunde. Well, on that note, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Take care and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard by the internet, shortwave radio, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz, every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 49 meters, 6040 kHz, and in southern Africa, via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kHz, every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the Internet. Our Internet address is pasttoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood qudde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Martyr Soleimani will live on forever and his enemies will disappear in history's dustbin. January 5th, 2022.
امروز هم مستکبران از نام او وحشت دارن، از یاد او وحشت دارن. ببینید تو فضای مجازی اطلاع دارید حد بیشتر از من نبود که چه برخوردی دارن با اسم او میکنن.
Today too, the arrogant powers are intimidated by the name and memory of Shahid Qasim Soleimani. Notice how they are treating his name on the internet. You probably have more information than me in this regard. This is another alert, and even more of a signal for us and for the officials in charge of matters related to the internet in the country, for them to understand what they should do in order to prevent the enemy from doing whatever he wants on the internet, wherever he wants. Well, the internet which exists in the world today is in the hands of the arrogant powers. They are even afraid of his name, and they are terrified of there being more people like him. This is what a role model is. They are afraid more people will be like him.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
شهید سلیمانی موندنی است، تا ابد زنده است. اونایی که او رو شهید کردن، ترامپ و امثال او، جاشون زباله‌دان تاریخه.
In any case, Shahid Soleimani is eternal and will live on forever. Those who martyred him, Trump and the likes, belong to the dustbin of history. They will be among the forgotten ones in the trash can of history. But he will live on forever. A martyr is like this. His enemies will disappear, but of course, after having received retribution in this world for their crime, inshallah. I hope all of you, his honourable family, his friends and colleagues, and Mr. Qa'ani, who is working and moving forward very well, praise God, will follow and move forward on this path, inshallah. God the Exalted has promised victory to us. Allah indeed defends those who have faith. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 38. He has promised to defend those who believe. Well, we are moving on the path of the divine will and divine goals, and the nation is working for Islam. This is the promise of defense. There is another promise about assistance. Allah will surely help those who help his cause. إِن تَنْصُرُ اللَّهَ يَنْصُرُكُمْ وَيُثَبِّتْ أَقْدَامَكُمْ. The Holy Quran, Surah 22, verse 40. And in another verse it stated, if you help Allah, he will help you and make your feet steady. The Holy Quran, Surah 47, verse 7. I hope that all of you will be successful, inshallah. The activities that this woman spoke about, Zainab Soleimani, the daughter of Martyr Soleimani, are good activities. I hope all these activities will continue in the best way, inshallah. May God's greetings, mercy, and blessings be upon you.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope.
Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Puraza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The eighth round of talks aimed at saving the agreement known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA, between Iran and world powers, is steadily moving on. The Iranian delegation led by Deputy Foreign Minister Ali Bagheri Kani has been in constant meetings with representatives of the three European signatories of the deal, Britain, France and Germany, EU coordinator Enrique Mora, as well as the Russians and the Chinese. Progress has been reported on talks concerning Iran's nuclear commitments, but there are still differences when it comes to the removal of US sanctions and the Iranian demands for verification and guarantees. Tehran says it wants assurances the US will not withdraw from the agreement again or reimpose sanctions. European and American diplomats have been voicing their concerns about the pace of the talks. An advisor to the Iranian team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, says the only reason progress is slow is because the Americans are resisting the notion that they have to give up sanctions.
I think the most important thing is that the Americans and the Europeans have still failed to remove sanctions or agree to remove many key sanctions. That is simply unacceptable for Iran. If the Iranians are going to put a cap on elements of its nuclear program, there has to be a change, of a clear change in the eyes of ordinary Iranians with regards to the sanctions regime. It has to be broken. Iranians have to feel that the Americans and the Europeans no longer have their hands on their throats.
Russian lead delegate Mikhail Ulyanov, who's been in frequent meetings with the American team led by Robert Malley, recently tweeted, "It's time to learn the lessons from the failed maximum pressure policy of the Trump administration." Iran says although there's been significant progress on technical matters, Differences, including those in the area of sanctions lifting, require political decisions mainly by the Americans that, if made, can lead to a durable agreement within a short period of time. Homolitsky, Vienna.
Is the British Home Office abusing its powers by denying a former Guantanamo Bay detainee his citizenship rights? That is the accusation being made by Cage's outreach director Moazzam Begg, who announced he's taking legal action in the hope of winning back his passport.
I've been arrested under terrorism laws three times, and I've had my passport taken away three times, all without any due process, all without any access to legal recourse, and all by governments of Britain, both Labour and Conservative. And yet I have not been convicted of any crime. I've never had my day in court. And I have actually been declared innocent by the very police that arrested me in the first place.
Moazzam is a British human rights defender who was made famous when he was detained and tortured by the US in Afghanistan's notorious Bagram prison and Guantanamo Bay between 2002 to 2005. Ever since his return to the UK, Mr. Begg's passport has been seized three times in just 8 years, the latest being in September 2021.
I gave evidence at war crimes tribunals. I have given evidence to the International Criminal Court for Britain and America's role in torture and abuse there. And I've looked at Britain and America's role in the rendition program with countries they claim not to have good relations with. And that, I believe, has been one of the key reasons why I have been targeted.
Begg has been accused of support for extremist groups in the past over his aid and investigative work in war zones such as Syria and Afghanistan, but was always found to be innocent. The Home Office has yet to publicly comment on this latest passport matter. This battle will be very significant, especially given the fact that Number 10 is currently trying to gift itself new powers to essentially remove people's citizenship at will with the controversial Nationality and Borders Bill. Many critics fear that the government just simply can't be trusted to wield powers like this fairly. Robert Carter, London.
It's been 1 year since U.S. President Joe Biden took office after defeating his contender Donald Trump in the 2020 presidential election. He took charge of the Oval Office with lots of promises, but let's look at where he's standing after 365 days. For one thing, Biden promised to bring the coronavirus pandemic in the country under control after Trump failed to do so. At the moment, the United States continues to be the world's worst-hit country by COVID-19, with more than 68 million cases and over 858,000 deaths. Infections in the past weeks have been jumping, reaching an average of over 800,000 cases a day. This is while, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, only 63% of the American population is fully vaccinated, and the numbers in southern states are much lower.
Look, folks, we're going to bring the Republicans and Democrats together and deliver economic relief for working families and schools and businesses.
These were Biden's words when he promised to get bipartisan cooperation to boost the U.S. economy and support the working class as, quote, the backbone of the society. Now we see that rift has not only widened between the two parties, but even the Democrats are divided over the issue, as some criticize Biden for not being bold or progressive enough with his agenda. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders says Democrats are on the wrong path and need to make a major course correction, pivoting back toward the needs of working Americans. Sanders believes that in too many ways, the Democratic Party has turned its back on the working class. Turning to foreign policy, Biden said last February that the U.S. would step up diplomacy to end the war in Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe.
But it looks like he couldn't keep that promise either. In December, the Senate supported Biden's $650 billion weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, even though Riyadh continues to target Yemeni civilians with airstrikes on an almost daily basis. Tensions between the United States and Russia have also escalated under Biden's presidency, especially more recently over Ukraine, with both Moscow and Washington targeting each other with tit-for-tat sanctions while warning against a complete rupture in their relations. And regarding the 2015 deal between Iran and the P5 plus one group of countries, Biden had this to say back in 2020, that his predecessor Trump had recklessly ditched the agreement, pledging that the U.S. would rejoin the deal under his presidency. But the Biden administration has been keeping the so-called maximum pressure campaign on Iran in place and has even imposed more sanctions against many entities and individuals, showing no serious intention in getting back into that agreement. The latest polls suggest that Biden is entering his second year in office with the worst job approval rating yet, affected by the COVID chaos, the messy and deadly U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan in late August. Biden's approval ratings started relatively strong at 57%, but by September they plunged to 43%. A new poll by Gallup and Morning Consult finds only 40% of U.S. adults currently approve of the job he is doing, his lowest to date. All in all, in the eyes of both Americans and the world, Biden has had a very disappointing record for his first year in office.
Iran's President Ibrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hussein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Bahrain has a tiny population of 1.7 million, but boasts the highest prison population per capita. Thousands of those are political prisoners. Every family has members who have done time, and the stories of torture and abuse are harrowing. Human rights organizations and defenders have been documenting them for years.
There is multiple evidence of torture against both men and women who have been politically outspoken. And there are people who have been languishing in prison for 10 years now. Children who have had their teeth knocked out, they have been raped, they have been they have had their genitals connected to electrical shock devices, car batteries or whatever, and have been driven around the villages, told that they would have their mothers or their sisters raped and violated if they did not snitch on their friends or the fellow villagers who would have been involved in the nightly protests against the continued abuse of fellow prisoners.
But this man, Omar Al-Hassan, the chairman of the Persian Gulf Center for Strategic Studies,